from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro, in for Michael Krasny. Next on Forum, Temple Grandin and her new book, The Autistic Brain. While the science of genetics marches gradually forward, those who live with autism have to live with it, the good, the bad, and the simply confounding. Families, doctors, and Grandin herself are sharing tips and tricks with each other to make the most out of life on the spectrum. That's coming up on Forum right after this. From KQED Public Radio, good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro, in for Michael Krasny. This hour, we talk about what we know about autism and what we don't. For decades, author and scientist Temple Grandin has been an iconic example of somebody living with autism who puts her strengths and even her limitations to good use. In her latest book, The Autistic Brain, she takes us with her into the lab to see what the latest in brain science can tell us and what it can't. The spectrum of symptoms is so wide, Grandin argues it's more helpful to focus on the individual than search for an umbrella definition that describes everybody with autism. Whether you or someone you love deals with this spectrum of issues, it's a fascinating read. Temple Grandin joins us in the studio. Thank you for being here.
It's great to be here.
So this is your fourth book for the general public?
Yes, it is.
But you've written tons of others?
I have textbooks, Livestock Handling and Transport, Genetics and the Behavior of Domestic Animals. Those are my textbooks. And I also have books that are strictly aimed at parents and teachers who teach autistic children.
This latest book begins with your trips to research labs to get your brain scanned every which way it's possible these days. The results seem to imply it's time we stop thinking of autism as a psychological problem, as a mental disease.
Well, it's been changed a while ago that it's definitely biological. In my book, The Autistic Brain, the history of the DSM diagnosis is reviewed. And you see, back in the 60s, they thought it was psychological. You know, now it's known that it's not. But the definition of autism keeps changes. You see, the problem is that DSM diagnoses are behavioral profiles. They are not precise, like diagnosing tuberculosis. You can't go in and get a brain scan and say, yes, he's autistic. The one thing in the brain scan that tends to show up, at least on the higher end of the spectrum, are the problems with face recognition, the social circuits in the brain. Some of those are not hooked up. That would be the closest to a brain scan for autism, but nobody's using it, even though that technology is 15 years old. As of right now, autism is strictly a behavioral profile, and it ranges from the socially awkward Silicon Valley computer programmer to a nonverbal person, maybe with epilepsy and other medical issues, that's very handicapped and is not going to be working at a high-level job. This is one of the problems, such a big spectrum. And one of my big concerns is I'm seeing too many smart kids, you know, get an autism diagnosis or an Asperger diagnosis, and not enough's being done to develop their area of strength.
That's something your mother seemed to take to heart right at the beginning, even before doctors knew what they were looking at with you. She seemed to say, all right, what are the areas that need working on? Let's work on those.
Well, when I was 3 years old, I had no language. You know, and then, of course, people that are on the milder end of the spectrum, there's no speech delay. And I got into very good speech therapy. I can't emphasize enough the importance of early intervention. Then when I got around third or fourth grade, that's when I started showing some areas of ability. And my area of ability was art. And that was always encouraged. But I was encouraged to do art of lots of different things, because a lot of these kids just want to do the same thing over and over again. My thing was horse heads. Well, let's do a beach. Let's paint pictures of some other things, because you've got to broaden the talent out.
The spectrum is so wide. Even people who might seem to be in the same camp in terms of social engagement skills might have totally different physical sensitivities. What's a family, a doctor, an insurance company supposed to do with something that is like a bucket of symptoms?
Well, in the little kids, if you have a young 2-year-old, 3-year-old that's not talking, that's where things tend to be the same. Early intervention, many hours of one-to-one teaching with ABA or one of the other teaching methods, and everybody can agree on that. It's when the kids get older that things really spread out. You also have sensory differences. Some kids cannot tolerate fluorescent lights because they can see them flicker. Other kids, it's sound sensitivity. They can't stand it when the smoke alarm goes off or the buzzer on the gym or the hand dryer in the bathroom, you know, certain loud sounds. And those often can be better tolerated if the child initiates the sound. In fact, that's one of the ways to help to desensitize that. But these sensory problems are very variable. I can't stand scratchy clothes against my skin, and I still absolutely hate them and can't stand it. The sensory issues are extremely variable, and the problem is, in order to treat sensory issues or to do research on them, you'd have to be diagnosing people, well, this person has a problem with fluorescent lights and seeing the print jiggle on the page. And that often responds to colored glasses and pale pastel paper. Another person has problems with scratchy clothes. You've got to break these sensory symptoms out into what the specific sensory symptom is. Otherwise, you can't treat it or you can't research it.
And yet, as you say, sometimes the solution to a particular sensitivity might be ridiculously simple, like printing on pink paper so that those letters don't jiggle quite the same.
Well, I find in my livestock handling class that I teach every semester, my students have to draw a cattle handling facility. And I find 1 out of 50 absolutely cannot draw. And they've got the visual processing problem. And I question them, and they'll see the print jiggle on the page. They hate fluorescent lights because they can see them flicker. Often hate escalators because they can't tell how to get on and off of them. And the treatment lots of times is very simple. You try on different pale colored glasses. And here in San Francisco, they have lots of good ones down at Haight Ashbury. Pale pinks, pale blues, pale lavenders. You've got to find the color that works for you. Also try different colored papers, try different colored backgrounds on the computer, different fonts, try that. Now the important thing with this is the person has to pick the colors that work for them, and colors that work for one person do not work for somebody else. But I have found just in my class, I've saved several students from failing out of college by getting them to get some colored glasses. I had one student come back and go, I got an A on my economics quiz because the PowerPoint slides no longer jiggle and I can see the graphs.
Because those answers are so simple, you would think that everyone would be sharing it by now, so that at least problems like those could be addressed and free up that child to excel without the hang-up, you know, given that there are answers.
Well, the problem is if you when the child's labeled autism, not every autistic person has this visual problem. It might only be 10% of them. You see, in order to work with sensory problems, you've got to diagnose what is the specific sensory problem that that person has. And I want to emphasize that people that are dyslexic, people with ADHD, people labeled learning disability or whatever, they can also have these sensory processing problems.
It was interesting that you go into the lab in numerous different research environments and get all different kinds of surveys taken. And there's no point in the brain where you can say, aha, there it is, the autism gene or the autism nerve issue. It's such a complex problem. We don't really have a handle on it.
The only thing that seems to be pretty much universal are the social deficits, the problems with face recognition. And there is a brain scan for that. It probably ought to be used. That would be the closest to doing a diagnosis for the core autistic trait. But other things, like I'm a visual thinker. I've done a bunch of brain scans and have found big visual circuits. In fact, the best picture of the circuits is in USA Today. Just type in USA Today Temple Grandin, and you'll see a great big circuit for visual association. Also found out why I was so bad in math, because my left parietal area is basically full of cerebral spinal fluid. But you might have one kid labeled autistic or dyslexic, you know, it's a really good visual thinker. Then you have another one that's a mathematician who's going to be very good at things like computer programming. And then another one that's a word thinker. You see, on the higher end of the autism spectrum, you tend to have uneven skills. Good at one thing, bad at something else. And in the Autistic Brain book, I describe the different thinking types. There's photorealistic visual thinker like me, often has trouble with algebra. And sometimes some of those kids can do geometry. You have the mathematician type of kid, visual spatial pattern thinker, often has trouble with reading. They're going to be your computer programmers. And then you've got the kid that's the word thinker. And we've got to build on strengths. Also, these different kinds of minds need to work together. Like Steve Jobs had a lot of autistic traits. And he was an artist. who designed the user interface. Then the engineers have got to work to make the iPhone work. You see, this is where you need the visual thinker and the mathematical thinker working together on projects.
I love the way you use the word or the phrase neurotypical to describe what I guess general society would call normal. It kind of cues us to stop putting qualitative valuations on the differences, because sometimes the difference that somebody with autism brings to the table might be an improvement on what we would consider neurotypical.
So you look at the milder end of the spectrum, it's just part of personality variation. But then you get down the severe end of the spectrum and you got a very, very handicapped child. They're not going to be working on any kind of high level job. This is one of the problems with this diagnosis. It's such a big spectrum. And I think when you get into some of the very severe autism, socially, the person might be normal, because in the Autistic Brain book, I profile Carly Fleischman, who is a nonverbal person with autism who types independently, describes how she cannot control her body movements, and she's infatuated with famous movie stars, you know, normal teenage interests.
There's a person there in that body who just can't completely express herself the
way
she wants
to. Well, she can't control her body, and a socially normal person. So you get into some of the severe autism is a different thing than the sort of geeky, socially awkward on the other end of the spectrum. And then to make things even messier, in the DSM-5, they've taken out Asperger's, which is the mild autism with no speech delay. That's going to get renamed social communication disorder, but it's still the same thing. And I think part of the reason for doing that is they're trying to cut down on the services.
Well, you've mentioned a couple times the diagnostic manual that psychiatrists use to diagnose patients that are brought to them. But it's not just a question of terminology. This defines what kind of insurance coverage people get.
Well, this is the reason for it. I mean, the DSM is, I'd say, half based on science, and the other half of it is committees, insurance codes, and squabbling over different things. It's not a precise diagnosis like tuberculosis or meningitis or something like that.
So I'm wondering... If a lot of people are using the term of autism to basically excuse the kid from duty on a lot of cases, to say, oh my goodness, it's autism, capital A, we must not expect this child to succeed in school, or we must not ask this kid to attend dinner parties.
Well, you got to stretch these kids. You got to push them just outside of their comfort range, or they're not going to develop. I'm seeing too many smart kids that never were taught how to shake hands. See, the problem is since the social circuits aren't hooked up, everything socially has to be taught, just like coaching an actor in a play. How do you behave in this foreign country? They got to be taught. And one of the things my mother did for me to teach me is I served hors d'oeuvres and snacks at my mother's dinner parties, and I had to shake hands with all the guests. That helped to teach social skills. The other thing we got to teach some of these kids is just basic things like how to shop. I mean, I'm seeing like a 19-year-old honor student that has never bought groceries by herself. That's totally ridiculous. You know, there's not enough learning of just basic kinds of skills. Another thing we need to do, and I have an entire chapter in the Autistic Brain on jobs for the different kinds of minds. Starting at around 12 or 13, kids need to start learning the discipline of work skills. And I wish paper routes were still around, because that'd be the perfect thing. But since they're gone, let's get some new paper route substitutes like walking dogs for people. I want something they got to do every day. Or every weekend they've got to work in the farmer's market, and it can be volunteer, but they've got to learn the discipline of working. Okay, it's raining and the weather's nasty. They're going to have to go to the farmer's market and they're going to get rained on. But that's part of the discipline of work. And I'm seeing smart kids graduate from college with a degree in something like philosophy, and then they get a job and they can't keep it because they can't get up in the morning. You know, there's just sort of a discipline here that when I was 13, my mother set up a little sewing job. And when I was 15, I was cleaning 8 horse stalls. I was going out to my aunt's ranch. I was doing carpentry work. I was doing internships in college. I had a ton of work experience by the time I graduated.
What was the hardest thing for you to master as a child?
Well, you see, there's different things that were difficult in different parts of my life. Probably the worst part of my childhood was teenage years with teasing. Oh, teasing is just terrible. There are some of these kids, especially the, you know, the more higher socially awkward kids, just getting tortured to death with teasing, where school is just torture. Some of these kids had to be taken out of a regular school. I was one of those kids. So if you decide to homeschool your kid, you cannot let him become a recluse in the house. He's got to, okay, might finish up online, but he's got to get out working. You know, I'm seeing too many smart kids becoming video game recluses, where that's all they do. And they're not going into the video game industry. If they're going into the video game industry, I'd be fine with that. And then they go, yeah, but there's cognitive benefits to video games. Yes, that's based on 30 minutes to an hour a day of playing video games. I have looked at some of that research. You know, one thing where a line was drawn in the sand with me is I wasn't allowed to just stay in my room all the time. I had to attend meals. I had to get out and do things.
Why is it important? I mean, if somebody has the capacity but is resistant. I mean, I can imagine a lot of parents find themselves pushing against the child's desire not to do those things.
What you got to do is you got to stretch them. You know, no sudden surprises. Sudden surprises cause panic. But you got to stretch these kids just outside the comfort zone. And when I was 15 years old, I was afraid to go to my aunt's ranch. And my mother said, well, you can go for a week or all summer. But she wasn't going to let me not go. And I ended up staying all summer. I loved it.
Something else you've talked about is using fixations to motivate kids.
Well, autistic kids get fixated on stuff, and one of the most common ones is airplanes and trains, because the kids enjoy the rapid movement. Well, then let's do math with an airplane. Let's do read about airplanes. Let's read about the history of aviation. You know, take that fixation and broaden it out so it isn't so fixated. I got fixated on cattle chutes. That ended up becoming the basis of my career. You know, you've got to broaden out fixations. You want to tap into the motivation of that fixation. You see, in the autistic mind's an associative thinker. So if there's an association, okay, let's read about a place where an airplane goes. Well, that's the whole entire world. But you see, there's still an associative link back to airplanes.
You know, in your own life, you found a science teacher when you were a teenager who sort of opened your mind to the possibilities. But it seems these days that there aren't enough of the good science teachers to excite anybody, the neurotypicals as well as the autistics.
Well, we've got it. Good teachers can really get a student turned on. And one of the ways my science teacher got me turned on is interesting projects. And the HBO movie showed the optical illusion room that I made. And that is absolutely true. And I have to say that I was happy to find out the stagehands had a hard time building that, even though they had the drawings off the internet. I didn't have the drawings. He wanted me to figure out how to make it.
We've got some comments already from people who are writing in, and I should mention that we do want to hear from you listeners on this subject. Give us a ring at 866-733-6786. You can post on our website, our Facebook page. You can email us at forum@kqed.org. Douglas writes on our website, Asperger's in particular is, in his view, a perfectly normal way of being. Every person I've met, he writes, who was an Aspie seemed quite normal, just different. Society shouldn't be too hasty or foolish to term everything a disorder.
Well, you see, this is the problem. You know, mild autistic traits are just a normal personality variation. There's no black and white dividing line between normal and abnormal. And this is where I get really worried about the labels. You know, you take the more real severe autistic kid, no language, they're going to need a ton of services, and they can't get the services without the label. You see, that's a very different sort of situation than the mild autism where, yeah, you're just kind of nerdy and not so social. And the thing is, you know, we wouldn't have a radio station if it wasn't for all the, socially awkward people that invented radio stations and keep all the electronics and everything running. Because who do you think made the first stone spear? It wasn't the social yak-yaks around the campfire, that's for sure.
Well, it's interesting. Douglas goes on to write that he imagines that, you know, this is part, what we're seeing is part of evolution, what helped us to get, you know, past, as you say, the stone and the spear. The genetic variations help us walk towards the horizon.
Well, that's right. And there's a lot of different kinds of minds, and a lot of it is just a personality variant. And, you know, I can think of kids I went to school with that I know are on the spectrum, managed to get jobs. Now, where learning about autism helped them was dealing with their spouses and their marriages. But, you know, social rules were taught in a much more rigid manner. And also, I think jobs today are getting more and more social. You know, people are putting more value on social skills. And you know, we got to find things that the kids that are kind of quirky and different get interested in. And it's hard, I think, for some of the teachers that are more social to get turned on to, might say, the world of all the kind of good geekdom. You know, I've told schools, you need to subscribe to Wired Magazine and Business Week. I was reading my new Business Week last night on the plane. It had all this stuff about Google X on there. Well, that's the kind of stuff that these kids that are kind of quirky and different, I'll be reading in the high school library. That Business Week magazine should be in there. And that's the Wired and Business Week. They ought to be in every high school. Every school ought to have those magazines.
A lot of people come up to you when you're talking, family members, people who have some condition on the spectrum themselves. What are they typically asking you about?
Well, they ask about a lot of things. You know, because you'll have moms come up where they have a very young child not talking. There I can give the same advice, tons of early intervention. And if they're not getting it, I said, get some grandmothers, get some students, get people to work with that kid. You got to teach the kid turn-taking. That's the same advice. I have a book called The Way I See It, which is strictly on, you know, for teachers and parents that actually have to work with autistic kids.
And you are getting a lot of fan mail, I should mention. Suzanne writes on Facebook, "Hi, Temple Grandin, you're a heroine at our house." It does sound like a lot of people look to you to sort of hold up the banner. Does it seem like a heavyweight, or are you happy to do it?
I feel it's a responsibility.
I'm curious. You were the subject of an Emmy Award-winning HBO film not too long ago starring Claire Danes. What was that like for you?
Well, I can remember watching Claire play me on the movie set. That was really weird. And I didn't stand on the sidelines because I thought it would be too weird for her. So I always watched it over the monitor. And then when I finally got to see the finished movie at a private showing, it was like going in a weird 60s and 70s time machine. Claire became me. I mean, it was just kind of a mind-blowing experience. And they really did things right. All my projects that I built were shown in the movie. I loved that, because I want to get kids interested in projects. And the sensory stuff was shown accurately, and my visual thinking was shown accurately.
And is it your sense that the movie sort of accurately displayed autism for general audience, people
yes.
who don't really understand what
yes,
it's about?
Yes, it did. It did. It was clinically accurate. Yes, there are some events that had to be compressed and changed around. But one thing we were very fussy about is that the movie is clinically accurate. And even on the building of the things, those were built accurately. I mean, if somebody takes an aerial view of my cattle handling facility off that movie and builds it, it will work.
It is sort of amazing to look at. I mean, when you say you're a visually oriented thinker, I think a lot of people who might have sort of normal skills in that area don't have a sense of how expansive your mind is when it comes to thinking visually.
Well, when I was young, I didn't know that I thought differently. I thought everybody thought in pictures. My mind works like a language-indexed visual search engine, and I can associate things together. And in the Autistic Brain book, I was so happy to find research that shows there's two kinds of visual thinking. There's photorealistic visual thinking like me, and then there's the more where are you located in space, visual, spatial, mathematical kind of thinking. And they're actually two different kinds of minds. And there's PET scan data.
Well, we're going to have to get into it in the next half hour. We'll continue our conversation about autism, its symptoms, how we define it, with Temple Grandin, author and scientist. Do you or someone you love deal with autism? How do you define it? Call us at 866-733-6786 or post on our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Rachel Miro in today for Michael Krasny. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro in for Michael Krasny. We're discussing autism, how we define it, with author and scientist Temple Grandin. Her newest book is The Autistic Brain, where she takes us into the lab to see the latest that brain science can tell us about autism and what it can't. Temple is a professor of animal behavior at Colorado State University. Let's hear now what our listeners have to say. We've got lots of folks calling on the phone. Why don't we start with Jeff in San Francisco?
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. Hello?
Oh, yes. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I have a brother-in-law who, for years, we kind of believed that he was a little unusual, eccentric. And then I work with kids, and I work with some kids with Asperger's, and I started to kind of relate what his behaviors to some of my students, and I mentioned it to my wife, and such things as, like your guest mentioned, he was a video game recluse. He did not know how to shop at a grocery store. He, you know, we sent him out to buy some things one day, and he kind of, you know, was dumbfounded and, you know, wondered how to do it. So we had to kind of explain things from going into the store, finding, you know, the bread, for example, taking it to the cashier, paying for it and such. I mean, he'd do some other unusual things. Like, I went to the gym with him one day, and he sat in the middle of the gym and listened to his music while everyone was kind of walking around him and working out. But anyway, recently a psychologist friend of ours met him and said that I think he has Asperger's. So my main question is, how do we broach the subject with my brother-in-law now that he's 32 years old, and we just want to be as sensitive but, you know, as direct as possible?
Well, I think one of the best ways might be some of my books. I mean, he could read The Autistic Brain. He could read Thinking in Pictures. Also, I'd like to get him out doing things. And I want to emphasize, it's never too late to start. You've got to stretch him. And when it comes to the grocery store, you're going to have to just take him into the grocery store step by step, you know, show him how to buy the bread. And then the next time you have him do it by himself, but you'll be out in the car. And then finally, he's going to do the trip by himself. You've got to just teach him.
Is it fair to say, Temple Grandin, that even though it is vitally important to reach kids when they're young, that we don't stop growing when we grow up and our brains don't stop responding to positive impulses?
Well, I always keep learning. People tell me my talks are better at 60 than they were at 50. You always keep learning. You know, I talk about bottom-up thinking in the autistic brain, and I'm getting more insights into that. It's never too late to start. Also, another thing that's really helped me on the recluse stuff is I take antidepressant medication, because one of the reasons why people become a recluse is they're so anxious they just can't stand it. When they play that video game, it calms them down. I used to lock myself in my room and read because I didn't have video games when I was a child. And I take a low dose of antidepressant, and it stops the constant panic attacks. And I found out in the brain scans that my fear center is 3 times larger than normal. Now, I want to emphasize that not everybody with autism has that, you know, enlarged fear center. And the antidepressants stop the constant fear. Now, there's way too many drugs given out like candy to kids. But there's definitely a place for a low dose of antidepressants in certain individuals with anxiety. And it's got to be a low dose, because if you take too much, you're going to get insomnia and you're going to get agitation like you drank too much coffee. And, you know, if he's not taking any medication at all, a low dose of Prozac in the morning might really help him out.
Well, thank you so much, Jeff, for your question.
Can I ask one quick thing?
Yeah. Sure.
Would you recommend that he see a psychologist or a therapist?
I think the most important thing is we got to get him functioning better. I don't like him being a recluse all the time. Let's get him out doing things. You could just start out and he can read the books. You can look up the DSM online. You can look up ICD autism. That's the international guideline. You can read the stuff online. It's a behavioral profile. You know, but the main thing I'm interested in, I want to get him functioning better. I want to get him out of the room and doing something other than playing video games all day.
Is it your sense, Temple Grandin, that doctors and therapists have a better idea of what they're looking at today?
Well, yes. And he sounds like, to me, just what you tell me, like he is on the spectrum. That's a very, very typical profile. But we need to start helping him to develop. It's never too late to start. And maybe he ought to go read The Autistic Brain. And I'd also recommend he read my book, Thinking in Pictures.
Jeff, again, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Let's turn now to Lori in Castro Valley.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to express how helpful it has been to read your book, Temple. I'm the mother of an autistic who is 21 now, and I want to let parents know that there are resources out there that they don't have to feel that they're isolated. There's things like the PHP, Parents Helping Parents, which is an informal group that meets over coffee. They talk about their experiences, what they did to help their child. One other thing that, as a parent of a young autistic, when he was very young, I was a lot like your mother, Temple, where I made sure I took him everywhere. I included him. If he had a meltdown, it was an opportunity for him to see how he could change and how his behavior affected his environment. So I'm old enough to remember that movie about Helen Keller. And we had in-house trial training, and some of the people that worked with my son were afraid to hurt him by making him do things he didn't want to do.
What's he doing now?
Well, now he's 21, and I've always had made sure in the school district that I had somebody from CASE for the IEPs, which is another...
Is he working now? What's he doing?
He is in school. They're teaching him job training. I had to transfer him to a group home, but I hired CASE, and now he's working out there. But he was in a fully work environment for 6 hours a day in the other school, in the Castro Valley School District, which is a great program, so...
And, Lori, for the benefit of people who aren't familiar with some of the acronyms you've been using, what is CASE?
You know, I forget what the C stands for, but the A is Advocacy for Special Education. And if you just do a search online, you could find out about it. And their actual attorneys, my attorney has a special needs child she's been advocating for his whole life. And when you show up the IEP, the Individual Education Plan, through the school district, I'm too emotional. I'm not the best person for the job to represent my son, so it's nice to have somebody that knows the laws, the rules, the regulations, and how to cut through the red tape. And one more thing I'd like to pitch for Temple's book, The Unwritten Rules of Social Relationships. I made a copy of the 10 Unwritten Rules of Social Relationships and put that on my son's door. So whenever we went out and we had an issue in public, we were able to look at the chart. And then instead of taking the emotion out and say, oh, look, you know, maybe it was just being polite is appropriate in any situation. Well, we could talk about that. We could define what the issue is, and it helped my son to do better. So I really thank you, Temple. We met you at one of the autistic conferences. You signed the book. You're fabulous. Keep up the good work.
Well, thank you very, very much. And I just want to add, because I know the show goes nationally, that, you know, she was discussing things out here in California. I just tell parents, join your local support groups. You need to track down, find out where they are. I mean, if you type in autism in the name of your city and state, that will usually bring them up. But that's the first place I would just tell parents anywhere out in the world to start.
Well, thank you so much, Lori. Pleasure talking with you. I guess she's already gone. Let's move on then to Melinda in San Francisco.
Hi there, Temple. This is Melinda here in San Francisco, once again, another California resident. You can tell from the number of calls here that we've got problems. But my son is in a very, very good care facility. It's a large campus called HeartSpring in Wichita. Are you familiar with
yes,
it?
Yes, I've been there.
Yep. So the problem for us is that he is about to be 19, and he's going to age out in 2 years. Please excuse me. And we're in the transition phase. So do you have any advice for us older kids?
Well, I have to know more about him. You see, the problem is autism is such a big spectrum. I mean, I've got the real mild kind of kid that, you know, be suitable for Silicon Valley. I need to know more about him. Is he fully verbal?
He is semi-verbal, and he is pretty severe.
Okay.
Yeah, so he's been doing some vocational training, but he's going to be not in any kind of a high-functioning
Well, he's going to have to find a group home to live in, and you're going to have to talk to people in your area. There's no way I can give out advice specifically for certain areas.
I think my question was more about, as he's transitioning out over the next 2 years, do you have any advice about how we can better use our caseworker to, you know, facilitate the transition?
It's very important in autism, for all levels of autism, to have a gradual transition. Sudden surprises cause just total absolute meltdown and panic. Like if he's going to be going into a group home, it'd be good to visit that home before he actually goes to live there. So it's not a sudden transition.
It's a very good question, Melinda. Are you finding support from I'm thinking, social workers locally?
Well, HeartSpring is a very, very well-run institution. They've been around for 75 years. And it's hard to get in. We're very fortunate. We do have a good caseworker there. Our regional center here, we're working with them. But I do think it's so important for parents of older autistic children to start early.
Yes.
And I'd like to get Temple's read on that. But.
Well, absolutely. And so that you don't just age out and then, boom, you don't know what you're going to do. You know, you're thinking about it, you're at least 2 years, you know, before that time. And unfortunately, I'm not in a position to give specific advice out on specific local situations. I just can't do that.
But is it your sense, Temple, that there are more facilities doing good work?
Oh, yes. And there's a lot of good facilities. And all I can say, you're going to have to talk to your local people to find a good facility in this area. And again, I can't give out specific – I don't have specific advice on specific local situations.
Very good point. Well, thank you so much, Melinda.
Thank you. Bye.
So Karen writes on our website, she loves hearing you, Temple, and has heard you speak over the years. She's got a daughter, 13 years old, on the Aspie side of the spectrum. She mainly has difficulty with OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, and misreading social cues. So hard at that age, such pressure to conform. She's very lonely, and she would love to have some good friends. And so the question for you is whether you've seen suggestions that they are doing therapy, social skills, group therapy, and anti-anxiety meds. She's also on those.
She's
as well.
Already taking something for that. Another thing that will help is lots of exercise. I want to emphasize the importance of getting friends through shared activities. Where I had friends when I was that age was things like, you know, craft projects. And then when I got a little bit older, it was horseback riding, electronics lab, a model rocket club. Get her involved in shared interests. You know, it could be music, it could be sewing, it could be art, it could be computer science, it could be, of course, I'm agricultural, so I love things like the FFA programs in the schools and 4-H. I was a 4-H horse member. Shared interests, finding the activities that she can share with other people, because that's where I had friends.
There are a lot of studies that show that especially horseback riding, where you're in close interaction with an animal, can have really beneficial effects.
Well, some people really, really, working with horses and riding horses is a really, really great activity. But I don't know enough about I'd have to ask more questions about what this girl's interested in and things like that. But that's where I got friends, is through shared interests. And sometimes the tendency to overshelter. I remember one mother called me up one time. She says, well, my 14-year-old wants to raise chickens for the 4-H chicken project. And I said, sign her up and you're going to have 5 hens in your backyard. You know, just get over that. This is the best thing that you could do for your daughter.
We should mention that Temple Grandin will be speaking at City Arts and Lectures at the Norse Theater tomorrow night, where she'll be interviewed by Adam Savage. And it's about 7:30 p.m., is that
yes.
right?
Yes.
And then tonight you'll be speaking as well at the Commonwealth Club.
That's correct.
You know, going back to this question of getting kids out and doing things to sort of stimulate their engagement with other people, could it also be said that music is another really strong
for
help?
Some kids, music is the thing. You see, this is where they're variable. The special interest things tend to vary. And I took piano lessons when I was a child. It was hopeless. Art was my thing. So when I grew up and I did my career with livestock, the design work I've done basically is a whole field called industrial design. And industrial designers work on many different kinds of, you know, product development. You've got to find what is the thing for that kid. Other kids, it's going to be writing. They love facts. They love the weather. Maybe they could end up being a journalist. I've been interviewed by both print and radio journalists that I'm pretty sure are a bit on the spectrum. And what they did is they made themselves very knowledgeable in a specialized area, and they got recognized for their knowledge.
Well, let's turn now again to the phones, where we have Chanel in San Francisco.
Hi, I am just thrilled to have an opportunity to speak with you this morning. Thank you. I have a 15-year-old son that I am increasingly becoming convinced is autistic, highly functioning. Examples of this is when he was little and I would take him to a playground, he would just stand and watch everybody. He wouldn't engage or play with the other children, but he would cry if I wanted him to take him home because he wasn't playing. And that's just one example. But now that he's 15, he recently, he will spend 16 hours on Minecraft, the video game, in his room and be perfectly happy and not come out of his room at all. He has really struggled in middle school. I had a comprehensive learning evaluation done in November that what it came up was that he was visually, spatially gifted to the extent that he placed in the 95th percentile nationwide. But he has a lot of struggles. He can't do math. He's struggling.
Well, I can't do math either. He needs to go into industrial design. Let's get him into some art classes. Let's get him into some industrial design classes. I can't do math either. But the mathematicians need us industrial designers so we don't have another nuclear plant disaster because the generator's flooded. Get him out. He's got to get out doing things, using his visual spatial skills. He's also got to start learning how to work. Minecraft has a lot of architectural elements. Maybe he could get interested in architecture. We got to get him out and get him interested in it's okay to play some Minecraft, but not for 9 hours a day.
Right. My biggest question here is how, because at school I have not been able to get him any help. He doesn't have an IEP. He has nothing because technically he doesn't qualify for.
Well,
any
wait a minute.
Help.
Let's just figure out how to solve the problem. Let's get him involved in some art classes. That's something you could just do yourself. Get him involved with a design group. Here in San Francisco, you have a lot of what's called maker community groups and hackerspace. Oh, I want to get him into hackerspace, you know, doing some really cool things. But we've got to get him out of that room. He also has got to start learning some work skills, even if it's bagging groceries at the supermarket. There's a discipline of work that he's got to learn. Because let's say he gets a great job in industrial design somewhere, well, sometimes you might have to design something you think stupid, but you just got to do the very best that you can do. We got to get him out of the house doing stuff. And there's all kinds of fabulous stuff right here locally in San Francisco.
It raises an interesting point, Temple, that you know, not every parent meets a school system that is willing to work with them. And so then you have to decide, well, am I going to take up that fight or am I going to focus on doing something else?
I want to focus on getting him out, taking his visual spatial skills so he learns a skill like industrial design. Let's get him in an industrial design class at the local community college right now. And those are usually quite affordable. Let's get him into that. And we got to start training him for the workforce. That's what we need to be doing.
Do you think it helps when you're talking about an older child, someone like this who is 15 years old, and maybe like most 15-year-olds, he's ignoring his mother's advice, to get somebody else in, another family member or somebody outside the family?
But you, first of all, you got to introduce him to interesting things. Like how would you like to learn animation? How would you like to learn, learn animation for making games? You see, he might be good at doing some of that, but you don't know until he's exposed. I'd like to get his butt out of the house and get him into community college, and don't worry about the age limits. Once he realizes it's a grown-up privilege to be there, and he can learn how to make some of this stuff. You see, he's got to start using those visual spatial skills. You know, and I'd recommend he read The Autistic Brain and Thinking in Pictures, but I got to get him out of the house doing stuff.
That's where it starts. Well, thank you so much, Chanel. Emily writes in, please tell Temple I love her, and she loves her advice for kids. My kids aren't autistic, Emily writes, but her advice is absolute no-nonsense parenting. And with that, let's turn now to Melissa in Moraga.
Hello. How are you, Temple?
I'm fine.
Good. I have a 9-year-old with Asperger's. And we live in the East Bay Area, and we moved here about a year ago. And I was kind of enthralled that so many parents out here still feel that autism is a stigma. They don't want to talk about it. They want to hide it. They don't want people to know. And I know when I went to the school and we did my son's IEP, and I was like, okay, so I would love to find other parents like me and find kids for my son to play with, because every time we've done social groups and things like that, in the end, after just sitting around and talking about personal space and eye contact and stuff like that, he was always like, "Well, I just want to play with the kids." And
What's your son good at?
He loves engineering. So I showed him your movie, and he was like, "This is the coolest thing ever." He loves to build and invent and things like that. And And I just felt like in the East Bay, there's just not much out there.
Well, there's lots of stuff out there for kids doing programming stuff. And you have all this maker community groups that make cool stuff. Introduce them to 3D printers. I know that's available here in Silicon Valley. I introduce him to all kinds of art stuff and animation software and things like this and engineering stuff. There's tons of great stuff online, like the Wolfram Mathematica site. You know, there's all kinds of things here. You know, let's just go in the route of his skill area, and then he'll find people to socialize with.
One thing that I have done is I did form my own kind of autism support and play group, and getting him together with other kids, I've noticed a change in him when he realizes, hey, you're just like me, I'm like you, no judgments, let's go play. And it's the first time, like, I've noticed he's a lot more confident in himself.
Good.
And because of that, I just noticed, as a parent, I'm like, hey, there's a lot of stuff out there, but I feel like nothing's really getting what he needs. And so I'm actually trying to open my own play and development center called the Friend Tree. And we're kind of in the process of, we're getting a lot of interest, and people are like, yeah, that's what we want. We just want a place for our kids to be themselves, to find each other, and for parents to be able just to connect and share resources. And, you know, so I just want to know what your thinking is about that.
I think that's a super good idea what you're doing. But I also want to add to it, you know, the public libraries in a lot of places. Again, I do not know every local thing in every city that I go to, but I went to a public library that had all kinds of fun tech activities and art activities there that kids can do. San Francisco is a huge city. There's got to be like great art programs or kids building programs and things like that where you can.
Right.
So you have your autism play group, that's good. But I also like to get him into a play group with art stuff, engineering stuff, hackerspace, maker community groups, things of this sort too. He's going to find friends there.
And I'd love to do that. I'd love to pull the resources that are already out there and put it in our center and be like, hey, these classes, these engineering and science classes are all geared to these kids. And
but there's stuff out there that's geared for 9-year-olds. Get them into
it. That's true. You don't have to recreate the wheel here.
No, there's stuff
places,
here.
Yeah.
I know that if I was sitting where I had a computer, I could find the stuff for you in about 15 minutes online, looking for stuff with children's art groups, engineering groups, animation. I mean, you've got everything here. So he has his autism play group, but I also want to get him involved with a play group and peers that go along with his special skill area.
And if I may recommend to our listeners, if you go to the Facebook page, there's already a self-selected group of parents there talking this hour. So you can put questions and get local answers.
Yeah, I can't do local answers.
It's a great resource. Thank you so much, Melissa. You know, a listener writes in, Temple, that there's, been research recently that has suggested there's a link between autism spectrum disorders and older parents.
Yes, that's correct.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, that's genetic copying errors, especially in the guy. You know, guys have got to make a lot of semen. And in order to make that semen, they're Xeroxing a Xerox of a Xerox. Photocopy of a photocopy of a photocopy. You see, to make more semen, you got to keep making a copy of that semen. And so you get copying mistakes. But that's just one factor. Other factors can be various drugs and things in early pregnancy. Also, there's some research that's showing the B vitamins and folate is really important. We want to make sure we don't get deficient in any of those kinds of things. But yes, there has been research on the older parents.
And is it something, just in terms of scale, are we talking about, each of these things making a 1% difference or a
3%
difference?
You can't quantify it like that. It's not that simple. But they used to think that only you had to protect ladies from getting bad chemicals or something on them. The guys are also really sensitive, too.
Oh, boy. So it's a bigger problem than anybody realized.
Well, yes, because those copying mistakes.
Well, let's turn now to Archimedes in San Francisco.
Hey, everyone, and hey, Temple. My question is, throughout my life, I've collected a group of friends and acquaintances, and the topic of being on the spectrum always comes up. None of us have actually been formally diagnosed, but whenever we see autism, in popular culture, in the news, we tend to pick out and fixate on certain symptoms, and we always think, maybe we're on it, maybe we're not. I don't know.
Well, the thing is there's no black and white dividing line. between on the spectrum or off the spectrum when you get into the mild spectrum. There's a point where it's just personality variation. And you can read the guidelines and you'll know, you know, but it there's no black and white dividing line between on or off.
So is there any advantage whatsoever to try to get a formal diagnosis, or should we just accept this as personality traits and have it continue
If you're in a stable job with stable insurance, I'd recommend keeping it off the electronic medical records. You don't need any services, and you can read. It's a behavioral profile. You can look up the SM. You can look up ICD. That's the international guidelines, ICD, autism, and you can read the list of the behavioral profile. You'll know.
Okay. Well, I mean, if it keeps it up to electronic records,
I'm not that big a fan of getting it. If you're a grown up, stable job, stable everything, I would be inclined to keep it off the electronic medical records.
Well, we've got time for one more question, Temple. Elizabeth writes, her dad, a loving, wonderful, successful man who's doing what he needs to do, but he's in his 60s now, and she suspects that he may have Asperger's. She says, do I rock the boat and bring it up, or
He's happy and doing fine, I would tend to leave it alone. I think a lot of adults out there that are kind of thinking about whether they're on the spectrum and they're in successful jobs and whatnot, I'd recommend reading The Autistic Brain. I'd recommend reading Thinking in Pictures, maybe reading some of John Robinson's books, Be Different, a really good book. And you'll know. You'll know from reading it because it's a behavioral profile. And reading some of the books, I have my Unwritten Social Rules book. That will really help people out with their spouses. It's where I have another book called Different, Not Less. It's 14 Asperger's diagnosed later in life because they were having relationship issues. And that helped them with their spouses.
Thank you so much, Temple Grandin. We were joined this hour by Temple Grandin, author of the new book, The Autistic Brain, Thinking Across the Spectrum. Make sure to catch tonight her at the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley at 7 p.m. Form is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online help from David Marks. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Our engineer, Danny Bringer. I'm Rachel Miro, in today for Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.